Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is the 28th episode of the Driving Eureka podcast. And in this episode, we're going to be getting back to the math of things, of what numbers that we need. And I got to tell you, Doug, in the last few weeks, I've been getting beat up by a lot of Deming people saying, what's Doug thinking? There are still unknown and unknowable numbers out there, and they give me examples like grains of sand and stars in the sky and things of that sort. What would you say to these folks that say, hey, you can't get numbers for these things?
Well, they just don't. I mean, yes, I don't know the grains of sand. I don't, nor do I care. Okay. All I know is that when you're innovating, numbers are your friend, and we can get numbers on all of these things. Now, there'll be variance in our estimates, but to not do them is just plain foolish, okay? You got to do the math. I mean, the secret to my success has been math. And if you don't know how to do it, you got to find a friend to help you with it. But you really need to do it. And it really came to me years ago at Procter & Gamble. My team and I were trying to sort out what to do after we got some really horrible product testing results. I mean, we got flushed. And a guy, and I think he was a product development director, I'm not sure what his role was, but a guy named Tim Feely stopped in and was listening to us, and he said, numbers are your friend when innovating. Of course, I looked up at him and like, not these numbers, dude. I mean, these numbers are horrible. You know, these are horrible. We just got flushed. I mean, in the whiskey business, it wasn't whiskey, but in the whiskey business, we call it a spitter. As in, after you taste it, you spit it back up again. You know, and it was one of those. And he went on, and we laughed, and he said a solid failure was a great gift, because he said it when you fail as badly as you guys just failed, the good news is you're not going to be able to kind of tweak it to fix it. You got to do something different.
Yeah, I gotta ask this question, which is, you've talked about, how you push the limits, those types of things. I'm assuming this may be before you had maybe that whole mindset. And, especially when I think of Procter & Gamble, I think of safe and, you're not pushing the limits type of thing. Is that kind of where you were in your mindset? Or have you always kind of, did you take the failure and know, I'm going to fail. I'm going to push the limits on what this product can do. And you hadn't quite put the numbers to it yet. Where were you kind of mentally at that time, moving from
where you are today? I knew what to do. I mean, I knew at the time, and we were pushing the edges on it. But the thing that came to me from Tim, which has stuck with me all these years, over 40 actually, is that people are scared to get numbers. And I think it's because psychologically they know deep down inside that they're probably not there. And they don't want to get the number to get confirmation on it. But the minute you go get the numbers, you can then start the next cycle of improvement. And I just had it happen to me at the ranch. And there was a team that was, there was a test that was scheduled to go out. And they had two ideas, and that one idea was ready. And the other idea, they said, oh, I don't know that we're going to be ready for it. We'll just pass on this. And I said, basically paraphrased Tim. And I said, numbers are your friend. Win or lose, we're going to be smarter than we are now. My vote is to ship the test. And they shipped it. And they set two records, okay. A record for uniqueness, the most unique in all of the ideas done, the most unique. And the worst purchase.
you have a lot of that, Doug. I noticed that. I remember the Johnson & Johnson thing. You had the best idea ever and the worst idea.
Oh, it's a package deal. And it was hilarious. But they did. And what was interesting was the idea created great debate the next morning, you know, as we're sitting there with it, there was a wonderful debate amongst people with regards to this idea. And the general conclusion was this idea is probably quite a bit ahead of its time. And I can't give you the details, but it's a technology that is just not there. It's really out there, really out there. And it was a healthy conversation about the future of where things are going. And so it probably didn't hit the objective for this project that we were working on. We were inventing these breakthrough ideas to ship in 3 to 5 years. It's not in the 3 to 5 year range. It's further out than that.
Oh, wow.
But man, it was so useful having the test. You could have debated this thing forever, but going out and getting the numbers, in this case, customer research results, data, not qualitative, data on the idea really helped. Now, when I'm talking numbers, I'm talking customer data on the idea, yes, but I'm also talking about forecasts for sales, for profits or fundraising or cost savings, as well as forecasts for the investment required to be able to have production capacity or marketing. And these numbers that you need are the key to you being able to generate the pull for your idea from investors, management, stakeholders. Because you see, they're all scared of your ideas. But when you can show them the math that shows them they can make money, then the one thing greater than fear, the one emotion greater than fear, is greed. Because now they see the opportunity to make money, and you've transformed your idea from an abstraction into a tangible business opportunity.
And there's one thing that's, as I'm listening to your talk, Doug, that's a little confusing to me, which is I can't quite, and maybe just can't reveal and just say if you can't, but is this concept of I'm shipping something, but the technology for the product isn't even there. What are you shipping? I guess, is there an analogy you could use? Or
we shipped, it was a concept prototype, concept prototype.
Ah.
So, yeah, and I just use the word ship just because that's the way I think it's going.
You're
sending it out. And so we sent it out to consumers, and it was a concept prototype of what this idea could do.
Got it. Okay. And so you got feedback associated with that saying, you know, they love the idea.
They hated the idea.
Oh, they did. Okay.
But it was really unique. Very low purchase intent, but a very high uniqueness. They said, wow, that's like nothing I've ever seen before, and I don't want to see it. See, there's different good and there's different bad. And this was different bad.
Okay, I got you now. All right. So now I understand. So the combination of that score when you read in here, you got a record high for uniqueness and a record low for purchase interest, meaning, yeah, that's really cool. Never would buy it.
That's right.
Okay. Now I understand a little bit. Well, that also kind of separates out from our conversation that we had last week about the concept prototype. And then I forget what the other prototype is called.
Functional prototype.
They're basically a trial balloon on just the concept itself, and getting feedback on, you know, what people think of it. Then is where they were in the process. And just by my understanding, are you always doing a concept prototype before a functional prototype? Is that kind of the order? Are they done concurrently, or
sometimes it goes both ways? No. Okay. Sometimes we'll have the product first.
Okay.
And we'll test the product, and then sometimes we'll have the concept, but it changes. Generally, I guess there's a concept prototype in most organizations first, although in our case, I mean, I'm a product person. I love product, and oftentimes I'll go make it first, because I figure if I can make something that's a wow, I can figure out a way to sell it. But if I can figure out a way to sell something, that doesn't mean I can necessarily, you know, break the laws of physics to make something. So I like the making. Now, sometimes you make something and nobody cares. That's a problem too. But I like to make it real.
Yeah, I know. I know we talked about this last week on about, you know, Shark Tank, those types of things. But people typically will have some functional prototype, I guess, or maybe even it's gone a little bit further than that, but that they're actually bringing something to the table. At that point, it doesn't make any sense for them to go back to do a conceptual prototype, does it?
No, but you got to remember that the people that are on that show, remember, right. It's an entertainment show.
Right, right.
If they don't have something visual, they didn't get through the screening. So.
Okay, yeah. I got you.
And weird hair helps. Weird hair helps. A weird accent, a bit of a nutsiness. That helps too, because it's entertainment. The more entertaining you are, the better chance you have of getting through.
So this isn't reality. Don't get your knowledge about how to innovate from Shark Tank.
Please don't. Please don't. Even their conversations, it would drive me crazy because the conversations of the other judges on patents or technology, I remember one episode, we're sitting there and this guy comes out and he's got this idea for a bike that when you pedal, it's like self-powered. It makes you go even faster because it's got this amazing flywheel thing in it. And he had all these amazing claims. And I said, And of course the other judge, oh, this is wonderful. You're a genius. You're a young teenage genius. And I said, this would be called perpetual motion. I said, this is not possible. Oh, you're not being open. No, it's just not going to be real. You can't do that. Okay. You can't do that. In fact, with patents, it's oftentimes, you know, one of the things with patents is if you can't do it, and the example it's always used is perpetual motion. It's just not real. And so these TV shows, the advice and what the judges are saying may or may not have any connection to reality. But don't get your advice from them.
Okay, that's a probably good way to end that particular segment. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor, Doug Hall. Let's go to the Driving Eureka book segment. And we're talking about math, and you're saying that math is the gas pedal for change. How does that?
We talk about it as math game plan. And it's the first math forecast of what impact the concept is estimated to have. It's either what your organization is going to realize from it, or investors are going to do it, or nonprofits, you know, connected to your mission, how many birds you're going to save, or students you're going to graduate, whatever it is. And the resistance to change inside most organizations and with outside folks is epic. And the primary reason for this is they can see the cost side of the balance sheet. They can see how much work it's going to take and how hard it's going to be, blah, blah, blah. But they can't see the benefit side of the balance sheet, you know, the revenue side. And so what you need to do is you need to help them see both sides of this thing. And when you do that math, that first estimate is going to have a lot of variance to it. So talking to the Deming folks, there's going to be a lot of variance to a lot of those numbers. Mm-hmm. I got it. But that's then the starting place for your plan, do, study, act cycles of learning to reduce that variance. So you run a test to reduce the variance. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the beginning, you got wild ass guesses. And then in time, you make it smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and you make it better and better. And that's how it works.
Yeah, can you give us like an example of where, because I know there's different things. So when we talk in terms of in a previous episodes, I probably ought to bring the term up on a more regular basis, but death threats associated with a product, as you start to address those, you start to reduce the amount of variation associated with your forecasting also. Do I kind of have that right? And can you give us an example?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So okay. Say you don't know, say for example, you don't know who this is going to appeal to. You don't know how many potential customers are there that you could sell.
Okay.
You're not going to sell them all, but you don't know, like say on a whiskey product, you don't know, is this product going to appeal to whiskey, hardcore whiskey drinkers, light whiskey drinkers, or non-whiskey drinkers? And, you know, you run a test and you find, you know, the hardcore group of whiskey drinkers is only about 18% of the population drank whiskey in the last 12 months in the U.S. Okay. It's just, that's it. Yeah. That's all it is. 18%. Okay. And within that group, you know, there's about 10% that probably consume half of it. And so you're dealing with about 2 or 3% of the population that are the heavy, heavy consumers of whiskey. And so, you know, the difference between the hardcore and then the next ring, if you're thinking about concentric rings going out, when you can appeal to that bigger new audience, then you're working with a much larger audience. And so in the beginning, you're going to guess at it. And then as time goes on, you get better and better and better as you run a test, you figure out who it appeals to.
And therefore, because you've now, instead of just saying it's 18% of the hardcore drinkers, you know, as far as the field of people that you have out there, now you know how much of percentage of that those people are going to be like the product that you're bringing out.
Actually, it's the other way around.
Okay.
So it's like this. You might say it's anywhere from of the people that drink alcoholic spirits, it could be 50% or 10%. I'm not sure.
Okay.
And then as you do the research, you find that there's about 20% that are the prime audience for this that are going to drive it. So you went from 10 to 50, 40% of the spirits drinkers, which is a huge variance. It could be that high or that low. Mm-hmm. And now suddenly you're at only a 20% because you know who the whiskey wannabes, the people who would like to drink whiskey but don't. That's the people that we want to get to.
Okay. So
as an example.
Okay. And so one of the questions that I have for you too is, you know, there's numbers out on the internet and people will make assumptions based off of those numbers. What I'm hearing at least, and maybe I have this wrong, is that you wouldn't start with those numbers. You would find out for yourself.
Well, I would, you know, I'd use the numbers that you find, you know, Googling to start. And I would cite them as to where they came from, so you had documentation with it. Mm-hmm. But then I would want to find out, that might be a general population of what goes on or what happens for most products.
Okay.
But then I'd want to find out what my idea is going to do.
Okay.
So I could start with industry data to start, or if you're inside a company, you can start with the last two times you did something like this, what happened, as your starting place, and then adapt it as time goes on.
Okay, because I sit there and I think, you know, how many of these numbers are actually wrong and where people have maybe come up with a product and they say, oh, only 1% of the people would use a product like that. And do they miss opportunities, have you found, Doug, by kind of taking what numbers are out there versus taking it, you know, a product and saying, you know, I don't know, that 1% doesn't sound right. You know, and maybe they look into the study or do a little bit more digging on it, but then they go ahead and go out and do it? Or does that kind of stop the whole process?
No, it's usually the reverse. They usually say they're going to sell billions and billions, and they're not going to.
Okay.
It's usually all too high.
And actually, you know, it's funny. That's one of the things that you hear on the Shark Tank a lot. You know, somebody say, this is a $60 billion industry, you know, type of thing that they're tapping into.
And let me just close this by saying, if you don't know how to do this, you got to get help.
Okay.
This is where you got to get help. You've got to either find a number person that you do or contact us at the ranch. We've got a project P&L thing where we'll look at your math and give you a review on it and help you with it. And it's really, really popular because, you know, the team at the ranch has done, I don't know, 20 or 30,000 sales forecasts. Mm-hmm. They're really good at it and they can smell it when it's wrong. Plus they've got lookup tables and reference standards that you're just not going to have. So just contact them. It's Project P&L is what you want to ask for. It's real simple. It's not real expensive. I'm not sure what they're selling it for now, but it's designed to be an easy thing for you to get. And then you've also got an independent source for your estimates.
Okay, good. This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. All right, well, let's go ahead and move on to the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. And you know, there were some nuances last week that you talked about that whiskey was a little bit more difficult when you're trying to put the numbers together for investors, but it looks like you kind of had the same problem with math and whiskey.
Oh, it's a disaster to do the math. It is so hard. I mean, think about it. Every state, province, country, different taxes and rules. The yield in a barrel will vary depending upon where it's been stored. The proof, the angels share what they talk about, leaks in the damn things. The three-tier system results in variable dips into who takes what profitability. Marketing and distribution expenses, capital expenses. I mean, you start building and then the building inspector says, I've thought about this and I've changed my idea, you know? And barrel aging requires high capitalization to fund the inventory. And without this math, it's almost impossible to make smart investment decisions on a craft distillery. Mm. The good news is that when you do sort it out, there are a number of clear pathways for making very good profits. Okay, so I thought what I'd do is I would explain if there's some approaches to doing this. There's kind of three ways that you can make money as in a distillery.
Okay.
Okay, the first one is a retail-focused distillery. And here you stay focused on creating an experience for your customers. You got to be awesome at cocktails, food, and consumer service. And if the regulatory environment allows it, some states allow you to have two or three of these, but you're basically a restaurant that happens to have a distillery. And these things are cranking it. If you really stay, now, if you don't care about food and the rest of this stuff, forget it. Don't try this. Mm. But you're creating just a wonderful experience for people to come, have some food, have some drink, and it works. It works. And if you stay constrained, you can make a decent income from this. And do well. Okay?
Okay.
The second one is cost efficiently create wild products and brands. And in this case here, what I'm going to tell you to do is very clear, which is buy an ice still to make vodka and gin. And then work with our Brain Brew team to create your own line of 2 to 4 award-winning whiskey brands. Okay? Because this is going to get you going with great product really fast.
Okay, so let me get some clarity on this, because you're saying to get an ice still and start making vodka and gin, and then you mentioned whiskey. Is there? I see a progression here. Are you saying that you need to make a vodka and gin first before you start making whiskey?
No, it just, as a craft spirits person, for most craft spirits people getting going, it just gives you a nice blend of stuff that you're making versus stuff that you're buying that's been customized just to your wood bill and stuff. And so it just gets you in the game in a very inexpensive way. I mean, literally for like 10% of the cost it would normally be.
Okay.
So it gets you some cash flow and learning.
Okay. So vodka and gin is just easier to make and lower overhead cost.
No aging.
Okay.
And especially if you do it with an ice still.
Okay.
You know, computer controlled, very simple, goof proof. They have incredibly good education, and we don't get anything from them. I'm just really a big fan of them.
Okay.
That's what we use too. Okay. So I love them. Okay. And then, you know, you got to remember that when you're a craft distiller and you're going to market. So in this case here, we're going to go to market in our local market and we're going to do cycles of learning and until we get ourselves a winner in the city. And you got to remember that first flood of sales are souvenirs. People are buying souvenirs of their local whiskey or whatever it is that you got. And so don't overthink this, because you're going to have a surge and then it's going to die. You got to get yourself in a repeat purchase where people are really buying it and drinking it. Now, when you get this done, go to another market where you're not a local legend. And the goal here is to validate that your brand and product has the potential to be scaled up. At this point, you know, you can use some initial investors to get started. And at this point, you might do another round of funding, because now you've got proof that not only in your market, but in a market where you aren't there, you've got something reliable and reproducible that can go. And that's how you do it. That's how you do it if you're going to do it with wild products and brands.
So vodka and gin are lower cost things to do that you can do in the ice still. So you can start to generate those products that generates some cash flow. Then you can start into the whiskey portion. And
yeah, I do them at the same time.
Okay. So you have whiskey, vodka, and gin. And then you're saying they're souvenirs. meaning that they're not good, or what do you?
Yeah, mostly in the beginning, I just want to caution people because I talk to craft guys and they go, oh, I just opened and I'm selling as much as I can do. That's right. You're filling a whole bunch of people buying souvenirs of you. I don't want to hear about the first sale. I want to hear about the repeat sales. Is your product awesome? And it probably won't be. Except, I mean, the stuff that you get from us will be awesome because we'll make sure it is. We'll work with you to help you get it. We're awesome.
Okay. But it gives you a starting point. I guess I was always kind of under the impression, and I know there, you know, you guys work on, you know, continually innovating the products that you have, that you would want to get it to a certain point where you're kind of, it's not a souvenir, that you're getting a product where people want to continue to buy it. But
you need money. Okay. You need money.
I got you.
Ship.
Okay.
Ship.
All right. All right. And then the third pathway here is something that you've actually talked about in the previous episode, which is if you're going to age it the old fashioned way, that it's going to cost you millions of dollars to do.
Millions of dollars and decades of time. And so if you've got a whole lot of money, you can do what the big companies do. Distill your own whiskey, putting it away for years. First couple of batches won't be very good, but after about 10 to 30 years, you'll be able to create a successful classic whiskey company like the big corporate brands. So that's the other option. Now, what you're not going to do is take your whiskey, distill it, put it in little barrels, put it in barrels with inserts, and have world-class whiskey. It's just not going to happen. You're going to have a new make spirit that tastes woody. And so you've got to decide, are you going to use, you know, something like us with time compression? Are you going to, or are you going to stay in white spirits where you don't have to do aging? Or are you going to buy aged stock that can be extremely expensive, just ridiculously expensive? Or are you going to just sit there and pray and let it go for a long time?
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. Doug, we haven't talked very much about the Brain Brew, how it's coming and what's up with it today, you know, what's been going on.
We are in production. We are making it as fast as we possibly can. The DSP, we have our license, and that's cranking. I am actually en route to Scotland right now to meet with Edrington, who's our partner, for a couple of products that we do for them, and in discussions about expansion, because the volume is 100 times bigger than we had anticipated it would be. And that's good and bad. 100x in sales is spectacular, but it's also very, very stressful on our system. And so, we just tested some more new products, some really high-end stuff that just did amazing. So the business is outstanding, but we need to expand already. And it's the tale of distillers, is that we tend to have not enough space. We build just what we need. So we're about to way overbuild so that we can literally do another 10x on our sales this year, which are going to be significant. But we're building for another 10x increase in sales with automated bottling lines and stuff like that. So
oh, wow.
It's pretty exciting.
Cool.
Pretty crazy, actually.
Well, you had talked about this in one of the previous episodes too, about the scalability of things and having to kind of keep the quality as you go, or you kind of step on yourself.
Yeah. So we've got, I mean, the compression, aging, that kind of stuff, we're fine with all of that.
Okay.
The thing that's our barrier right now is packaging. We have, like most people, a manual packaging system, and we really need a full automated line to be able to do it at the speed that it is. It's a packaging issue right now. We're fine with capacity. We've got plenty of equipment and systems are really good in that case. It's the packaging that's the problem right now.
Okay. All right.
The other thing, Trip, that you're going to get, and if you're thinking about starting one of these things, you need warehouse space. I mean, even though we don't have to store barrels, when you start to get to the flow that we're at, sending pallets out every week, you need warehouse space for empty bottles, filled bottles, caps, label. I mean, it's just amazing how much pallets, when you're selling pallets and pallets of product, it just takes up room. And you got forklifts and stuff. It's amazing.
So this is the reason that you're trying to get ahead of it with the additional space then is in anticipation of how you're growing presently. Interesting. Okay, well, let's go to our craft cocktail recipe, the Rum Runner Beach.
Yes, I'm thinking summer. Okay, I'm ready. We have a Brain Brew beach bar in Prince Edward Island on New London Bay, where I have a home. And I will go up there somewhere around June. And I am a great fan of tiki drinks. So this summer, you're going to get a bunch of tiki drinks. But tiki drinks, instead of made with rum, I like to use our Relativity, which is the easy drinking whiskey up in the Boston area. And so it just gives more depth and character to it. And so the Rum Runner Beach it's twos and ones. I make it simple because after you've had a few, you got to keep the measurements simple unless you do it. And that is, I'm telling you the truth. And so two ounces of Relativity, easy drinking whiskey, 1 ounce of coconut cream, 2 ounces of pineapple juice, and 1 ounce of orange juice. So 2 whiskey and 2 pineapple, 1 coconut cream, 1 OJ. Shake it with ice and then put some nutmeg, sprinkle some nutmeg on top. And umbrella's optional.
Okay. There's something missing from the Rum Runner Beach ingredients, Doug.
I know. I just thought it was fun to call it that.
I'm still looking to see where the okay. So you replace the rum.
You can use rum if you have to, but no.
Use the Relativity. All right. Well, you got your mind on summer already. So I'm still at 50 degrees right now and rainy. So okay. Well, that closes out our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. Final comments, Doug.
No, I'm off to England and Scotland and all places beyond in Geneva as we're doing things. So I'll have some stories for you when I get back of some of these cool adventures. I'm going to be seeing a whole lot of really cool people talking about trends. But it is kind of crazy in that I'm kind of, you know, coming from the colonies over to the old country to teach them a little bit about whiskey. So that's always humorous, you know.
You probably don't want to say that. Hopefully this episode will come out after you're back. So
No, I tell them. You do? My mom's family came from Thurso, Scotland, up on the north end of Scotland, and I always do it with a good sense of humor with them, and I just say, "Well, I'm going to give you a little lesson today in whiskey." And of course they all laugh. But got a ton of meetings. I mean, I think I might be 12 to 15 different meetings over basically a week's time. And it should be exciting. And it's going to be exciting to see because we're you know, I've got some products with me, as always, that kind of push the envelope on things. And so it's going to be interesting to see what people do and to learn. I've got some really cool people that I'm excited to get with because they're interested in helping us and being part of it. And I'm interested to hear their ideas as to what they've got too. So these
meetings are going to be all over Scotland and England. Then is that
yeah, and Switzerland and Switzerland.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to be in Switzerland. Okay. Yeah. We've got a potential thing in Geneva. We may be doing bringing Brain Brew to Switzerland. And, so I'm having a meeting there with some people too. So it's some Eureka Ranch work. I'm doing some of that too. So it's a kind of a hodgepodge of things, and lots of miles of traveling.
All right. Well, a lot of planes and a lot of trains, especially That's getting right. around England and Scotland. All right. Very good. All right. Well, have a safe trip, Doug, and we look forward to talking to you and get back about your adventures.
Thanks a bunch.
Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for limited time 4 things. A 1 hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book, a subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. the Driving Eureka Prescription for Success. You answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.